Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of our Finals Countdown series, which is, as always, brought to you by MedTalks. In this series, we are providing all of you wonderful medical students, in other words, the future of our healthcare, with short, succinct, and super useful revision talks for your upcoming exams, and generally for life beyond as doctors. In this series, we're currently in the gastroenterology section, and in the previous talk, we spoke about altered bowel habits, so constipation and diarrhea, and these are available now completely for free, so do check those out if you haven't already done so. But in today's talk, we'll be looking at another very common topic, and that is peptic ulcer disease. But before we get on to talk about that, I'd just like to mention the sponsors of this episode. And this episode is proudly sponsored by BetterHelp, and that's help as in H-E-L-P. And guys, for all of you listeners who are stressed with revision and upcoming exams, sometimes this can get quite overwhelming, and we have all been there. If you feel like things are getting a bit much for you, then BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who are trained to listen and to help you. You can talk to a therapist in a completely private and online environment at your own convenience. There is a broad range of expertise in BetterHelp's 20,000 plus therapist network that gives you access to help that may not be available in your area. And all you have to do is just fill out a questionnaire to help assess your specific needs, and then they can get you matched with the therapist in just under 48 hours. After this, you then schedule a secure video and phone session. Plus, you can exchange unlimited messages, and everything you share is absolutely and completely confidential. You can also request a new therapist at no additional charge anytime. Join the 2 million plus people who have taken charge of their mental health with an experienced BetterHelp therapist. And just to make things even better, there is a special offer to all of you MedTalks listeners. You can get 10% off your first month at BetterHelp by entering the URL betterhelp.com/medtalks. That's betterhelp.com/medtalks. Thanks again to BetterHelp for sponsoring this episode. Okay, so let's get straight into it and look at peptic ulcer disease. What will we cover in this episode? Well, we'll define what peptic ulcer disease is, look at the epidemiology and statistics, we'll have an overview of the risk factors and causes, then we'll touch on the clinical features, we'll explore any differential diagnoses, then we'll move on to investigations, and then management, and then look at the complications and prognosis. So peptic ulcer disease is an umbrella term for gastric ulcers, so that's ulcers within the stomach, and duodenal ulcers. And duodenal ulcers are more common. And essentially it's the ulceration of mucosa of either of these, so the stomach or the duodenum. Now the stomach mucosa is prone to ulceration as a result of the increase in stomach acid or the breakdown of the protective layer of the stomach and the duodenum. And there is a protective layer in the stomach which is comprised of mucus and bicarbonate. And this is secreted by the stomach mucosa. And there are lots of different things that can lead to its breakdown, which I'll mention shortly. So essentially, a peptic ulcer is a break in the lining of the GI tract, which will extend through to the muscularis mucosae, so the muscular layer of the wall. And it's diagnosed endoscopically. And as I said, they can technically appear anywhere within the GI tract, but they're most common in the duodenum. So, the normal defensive mechanisms in the gastrointestinal mucosa are bicarbonate, mucus secretion, prostaglandins, and mucosal blood flow. And an imbalance of these factors that protect the mucosa of the duodenum in the stomach leads to peptic ulcer disease. The most common causes of this imbalance is the presence of Helicobacter pylori or H. pylori or non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. Other risk factors include smoking, alcohol, use of steroids, stress, or a change in the consistency of the gastric mucus. And these are the major components of the mucus bicarbonate layer that protects the gastric epithelium from high concentrations of stomach acid in the stomach lumen. So, talking more in depth about Helicobacter pylori or H. pylori, now it's a bacteria which lives in the sticky mucus that lines the stomach. Around 40% of people in the UK actually have H. pylori in the stomach, so it is really common, but in about 8 to 9 out of 10 people who do have it, it doesn't actually cause any problems. but in about 15% of people with the condition, they get ulcers either in the stomach or the duodenum. And these ulcers will lead to symptoms like, or signs like, indigestion, and they can become more serious and bleed, and I'll touch more on that shortly. So let's now look at the clinical features of peptic ulcer disease. Sometimes symptoms can be quite non-specific, and it means that a diagnosis can be unreliable on just taking a history alone. The most often symptom is epigastric pain, and this is usually after meals, about 1 to 3 hours afterwards, and it can often wake the patient up at night, and it can be relieved by food. Other symptoms will include nausea, distension of the abdomen, bloating, oral flatulence, and intolerance of fatty foods. But the intolerance of fatty foods is also associated with having gallstones. There may be heartburn or dyspepsia, although it's more typically associated with gastroesophageal reflux disease. And a posterior ulcer can lead to pain which radiates to the back. In terms of the signs, there may be very little to find on examination, so there might be some epigastric tenderness. As always, we need to consider the differential diagnoses, think about what else could be causing these same symptoms. So as I mentioned a few before, gallstones can lead to abdominal pain after fatty food, gastroesophageal reflux can present with dyspepsia, other causes may be chronic pancreatitis, an abdominal aortic aneurysm, a gastric cancer, inflammatory bowel disease such as Crohn's disease, diverticular disease. Some medications can lead to dyspepsia, so drug-induced dyspepsia, hepatitis, acute ulcers, which can occur at times of severe physiological stress, so severe burns or head injuries. A syndrome called Zollinger-Ellison syndrome should be considered, particularly if the H. pylori tests are negative or it's been eradicated. Zollinger-Ellison syndrome is a triad of severe peptic ulcer disease, gastric acid hypersecretion, and a gastrinoma. And because of the location of the pain, so an epigastric pain, we must make sure we don't mistake this for a chest pain. So another cause to consider would be coronary heart disease. Now we'll move on to the investigations. So we can do some baseline blood tests, and a full blood count may show evidence of iron deficiency anemia. But the main two tests that we want to do are testing for H. pylori, and this is using a carbon-13 urea breath test or a stool antigen test. The way the carbon-13 urea breath test works is a patient will swallow urea that's labelled with an uncommon isotope, so that's the carbon-13, and then 10 to 30 minutes later, detection of the isotope labelled carbon dioxide in the exhaled breath will indicate that the urea was split, and this indicates that urease is present in the stomach. And this is the enzyme that H. pylori uses to metabolise urea, and therefore, if this enzyme is present in the stomach, this suggests that H. pylori bacteria are present. And that's how the urea breath test works. So the most diagnostic method to identify peptic ulcers is via endoscopy. And nowadays, during the endoscopy, a rapid urease test can be performed to detect for any underlying H. pylori. And the ulcers should also be biopsied during the endoscopy to exclude any malignancies, because ulcers can look similar to malignant tumours during the procedure. And the NICE guidelines actually advise to repeat an endoscopy towards the end of the PPI treatment to ensure there's been resolution. And another non-invasive method for detection of H. pylori is the stool antigen test, which tests for the antigens that are associated with H. pylori within one stool. The NICE guidelines say that referral for an urgent upper esophageal gastroduodenoscopy, so OGD, should be done for patients who present with either a new onset dysphagia or age over 55 with weight loss and either upper abdominal pain, reflux or dyspepsia, or new onset dyspepsia that's not responding to proton pump inhibitor PPI treatment. Now, classically, any pain from a gastric ulcer is exacerbated by eating, whereas with duodenal ulcers, they are worse 2 to 4 hours after eating, or even can be alleviated by evening eating. So gastric ulcer eating can make the pain worse. Duodenal ulcers eating can make the pain better. Hey guys, just a quick one. If you, like me, are iPad lovers and spend all of your productive time on your iPads making notes for exams or making notes for anything else, then I cannot recommend enough the paper-like screen protector. The number of times I've scratched my unprotected iPad screen after using different styluses or styli, but since having the paper-like screen protector, it's kept my screen extremely well shielded. Its nanodot surface technology provides a better tactile feel, increased stroke friction, and minimal light diffraction so that making art and taking notes on an iPad feels as natural as writing on paper. Made for the iPad and Apple Pencil, Paperlight delivers the unforgettable feeling of real paper into your digital workspace. To find out more about this wonderful creation, you can just head on over to their website by searching paperlight.com/medtalks, and I will leave this link in the episode description so you can have a look after you've listened to the episode. And if you are interested in purchasing a Paperlight screen protector, then please do enter the code MEDTALKS at the checkout page. And again, I will leave that all in the episode description. Okay, back to the episode. So now I'll move on to talk about the management of peptic ulcer disease. Now, the first line may be modification of behavior. So for example, if medication is a cause, such as NSAIDs or steroids, then these should be stopped or replaced if this is not possible. And being more meticulous about the instructions. So for example, taking NSAIDs after food may be required. Other lifestyle modifications would be cessation of smoking, reducing alcohol consumption as well. Now, if patients test positive for H. pylori and it's H. pylori associated ulcer disease, then we need to eradicate the infection. And that will be triple therapy, so use of two antibiotics and a proton pump inhibitor. But otherwise, patients who have suspected or confirmed ulcers will be started on a PPI for 4 to 8 weeks to reduce the acid production, and then they should get reassessed after this period to see if the symptoms have resolved, and this is the test and treat approach. If there is persistent symptoms after PPI and eradication therapy, then this will require further workup, with the first line being an urgent OGD to exclude any underlying malignancy. And after this, other causes of treatment failure can be considered, such as failure of the H. pylori eradication, which may warrant further triple therapy, or the Zollinger-Ellison syndrome, as I alluded to before. The NICE guidelines state that if an ulcer is associated with NSAID use, then a PPI or a histamine 2 receptor antagonist, such as ranitidine or loratadine, should be used for 8 weeks, followed by H. pylori infection eradication treatment if the patient has tested positive for H. pylori. In those patients who have tested negative for H. pylori and have no history of NSAID use, then a PPI or an H2 receptor antagonist should be used for 4 to 8 weeks. For those patients who have peptic ulcers, so that's gastric or duodenal, and who have tested positive for H. pylori, they need to be reviewed in 6 to 8 weeks after starting their eradication therapy and retested, and this will depend on the size of the lesion. Patients who have a gastric ulcer and have tested positive for H. pylori should also have a repeat endoscopy 6 to 8 weeks after treatment to ensure that the ulcer has healed. And if the ulcer has healed and the patient's continuing to take NSAIDs, then the potential harm from NSAID treatment should be discussed. The need for NSAIDs should be reviewed at every 6 months and used on a limited as needed basis trialed. And the dose should be reduced, or the NSAID should be substituted with something like paracetamol or an alternative analgesic or low-dose ibuprofen. In patients who have had previous ulceration but NSAID use is necessary, or those at higher risk of gastrointestinal side effects, then a COX-2, so cyclooxygenase 2 inhibitor, should be considered instead of a standard NSAID. If the symptoms recur after initial treatment, then a PPI can be taken at the lowest dose possible to control the symptoms, and again it should be used on an as-needed basis with patients managing their own symptoms. And in those cases where there are persistent symptoms or an unhealed ulcer, then the patient's adherence to the initial management should be checked and the lifestyle advice should be reinforced. Other causes when there is persistent symptoms or failure to respond to treatment should be considered, such as malignancy or failure to detect H. pylori, inadvertent NSAID use, or other ulcer-inducing medications. These should be investigated. I'll just briefly touch on the complications of peptic ulcer disease, and the ones that we should all be aware about are perforation of the ulcer, which can then lead to massive hemorrhage, and the perforation can lead to an acute abdomen and peritonitis, which will need urgent surgical repair via a laparotomy. Also, ulcers can lead to scarring and strictures of the muscle and the mucosal layers, which can cause narrowing of the pylorus, which is the last part of the stomach. And this can cause something called pyloric stenosis, where there is difficulty in emptying the stomach contents, and it can present with abdominal pain, distension, nausea and vomiting, and this is exacerbated by eating. But this is very rare, so just be aware of that. And so that brings us to the end of this episode, where we've covered peptic ulcer disease. As promised at the beginning, we've gone through what peptic ulcers are, the different types, the pathophysiology, we've looked at the risk factors and how they present. We've then talked about the diagnosis and the NICE guidelines in terms of diagnosing via endoscopy, urease test, and then the actual management with lifestyle modification, PPIs or H2 receptor antagonists, and the H. pylori eradication therapy. Finally, we touched on some of the complications. I hope you've enjoyed this episode and found it useful. Please remember to share it with your friends, peers, and anyone else who may find it useful. Remember to give us your feedback on social media platforms. You can drop a comment on the Apple Podcasts channel if that's where you listen to these. And we've got lots more content coming up, so do stay tuned. We wish you all the best with your revision and upcoming exams. Good luck, and we look forward to bringing you lots more. Thank you.